All right, well, we are going to finish our Purpose of Life series tonight. So if you leave here with any questions about the purpose of life, you can ask Janice. Okay? I want to start out by telling two stories of some friends of mine in college. So the first story is about a friend in college who was really into a certain girl. Okay? And this friend really liked her, and, you know, they're kind of friends, they spent some time together, but it was, you know, he really wanted it to go further, and it was always kind of this question, like, is it going to go further, is it not? There were times when maybe he thought she might be into him, and times when he thought maybe she wasn't. He wasn't really, like, part of her crowd, but they knew each other and they had mutual friends, so sometimes they hung out, and kind of he's always trying to get her attention. And at times, you know, it looks like something might happen. You know, they'd hang out and it would be really cool, they'd have a fun time, and it'd be like, oh, maybe this is going to go somewhere, and then they don't see each other, and it kind of never worked. And so this kind of went on through a lot of college, and it's kind of always up and down. And there was always this hope for this guy. Always this hope that it would go further, that something special would come of this relationship. And then they graduated and kind of went their separate ways, and nothing ever happened. And I've talked to that guy since, and he's moved on, life's gone, but there's always this question, like, what if? What if something could have happened there? What if circumstances were different? What if things had worked out a little better? What if we'd clicked and she realized something and it had gone somewhere? What if things had worked out differently? That's the first story. Second story is about two people who lived in the freshman dorm that I lived in. These two people had different ways of looking at the world. They had different worldviews. And turned out that they lived very near each other. They were on the same floor and kind of across the hall. And so they often ended up talking about these worldviews together. One of the guys... tended to be fairly hostile, fairly aggressive in kind of attacking what he perceived to be an inferior worldview, which put the other guy on kind of the defensive, and he ended up kind of always trying to prove himself, always trying to prove this worldview that he believed in, always trying to convince this other person, who was usually trying to poke holes in his system of thought. And it got to the point in this freshman dorm that you just kind of knew what was going to happen when these two people were in the same room. And, you know, the conversation would start and everybody in the room would kind of be like, all right, I need to be somewhere else. Because you knew it was going to erupt into this argument, into this debate, and nobody wanted to hear it again. It just kind of became very tiresome. One of them sometimes would... the guy in the defensive, he would sometimes try to be nice, you know, kind of try to win this person over with love, try to demonstrate that there was something moral, something about the way he saw the world that caused him to be able to be kind, thinking that might break down some of this hostility. But it never worked. It only created more of an opportunity for this person to be hostile and aggressive. So this kind of continued this way for most of the year, and then freshman year was over, and they lived in different places, and things cooled down. So one story about the guy who wants the girl, but just can't quite get her. Another story about two people conflicting aggressively over worldviews. Both of these stories that I've told are actually about outreach. They're both about evangelism. They're both about the message of Jesus Christ going out into the world, but in very different ways. Which is more attractive? What do you guys think? You can answer now. The guy who's trying to woo the girl, or the two guys that are trying to fight their worldviews?
Well, the guy trying to woo the girl would be more attractive if he actually had some success. Asked her out.
True. It's been a tragedy.
Did he ever even, like, ask her out?
He did. She just never really responded. Which one's more common? So, this kind of paradigm, which, when you think of evangelism, what do you think of? What's that?
Debate.
What else?
Coercion.
What else do you think of with evangelism?
Door-to-door. Church people.
They're selling religion, right? What else? What?
TV. Sharing.
Crazy.
What I think of is sort of like coercion, but it's basically I'm right, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm loving you by showing you what's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm right, you're wrong. But you could be right too if you think the way I think. Right?
Well, fundamentally, the way I characterize evangelism is the intent behind that is I'm loving you by showing you what is right.
And that you're wrong.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody have positive associations with evangelism? Mark,
I've always, in my experience, it's always, for me, it's been kind of just sort of like living my life as a Christian. And when I'm given opportunities to speak to people that, for the best of my knowledge, don't know Christ, sort of talking to them, and a lot of times people will ask me questions, why don't you do this, or why do you believe this, and then I'll respond. So it's never really been like a negative experience.
Yeah, that's how I try to make myself feel better about it.
How?
Like what he said, like that's how I try to think about it, but I try not to think about the word evangelism with it. Because evangelism has bad connotations.
That's bad connotations. Okay. Well, these two stories, so the first story about the guy and the girl, the guy was God, in case you hadn't picked that up. And this particular friend of mine, which probably you hadn't. I'm trying to figure out a better way to. I'll work on that one. He did kind of ask her. That's why
you didn't make that clear.
I know.
You still want to ask her out.
I know. I feel bad for the guy.
You should feel bad for him.
I was wishing he would take a little more initiative. But now I'm seeing things.
I'll tell the story from the next time.
What's
that?
Maybe the initiative that was lacking is we should have shown more about God to the girl.
Ah, interesting. That connects. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So this is actually a true story. This is a friend of mine who seemed to kind of always flirt with faith in a way. Kind of interested, but kind of not, and kind of would hang around God and then get distracted by other things, and eventually they ended up being more distracted than not. And the other two people you probably figured out were one was a Christian and one was not, and didn't like Christians and liked to debate them and liked to argue, and it ended up being pretty uncomfortable for most people. So what I want to talk about tonight is kind of, is there a different way to think about outreach? Is there a different way to think about evangelism? And the kind of idea behind this came, we're finishing up this series on the purpose of life, and I've suggested there's three purposes that we've talked about: work, community, and romance. Now, If you've been in church for a while, and depending on what types of churches you've been at, some people will say that that there is one purpose of life, not three, and that one purpose of life is evangelism. We actually went to a church like this in Dallas once, but they said, you know, the Great Commission, that is our singular thing. So when you come to this church, that's what we do. We're all about the Great Commission because we believe that once you believe in Christ, the singular goal for your life is to get other people to believe in Christ. That's your purpose of life, evangelism. And I think that can be a fairly common perspective. Sometimes it's not articulated that clearly, but it can be communicated that kind of the whole goal is evangelism. So we put together this series, Purpose of Life, and we didn't mention evangelism at all. So what does that say? Does that mean that evangelism is not important, that it's not a part of life? Or is it, but does it come somewhere? So what I'm suggesting is that evangelism comes under the category of romance. And what I want to do is look at John 3 as kind of an example of how this might play out. But first I want to kind of talk a little bit about my personal history. I grew up in the church. I grew up in a Lutheran church, and I had never even heard the idea that that Christians are supposed to share their faith or witness or evangelize or whatever you call it. I was ignorant of the idea until I got to college, and I started being involved with Christian fellowships, and they seemed to think that evangelism was really, really important. Probably not exactly true. Maybe in high school I heard a little bit about it. But in college it was kind of like, hey, this is what you need to be doing. So I tried it. And I kind of got excited about it and said, okay, God, you know, I'm going to be faithful. I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this kind of a big focus of what my life is about. And I did. And for the most part, and by that I mean for the whole part, it was frustrating. I never kind of had the magic moment where everything fell into place. And I felt a lot of times like I was doing this thing, but there wasn't much behind it. And there was one point in particular in my sophomore year where I was praying for people and I was trying to talk to people. And at one point I stopped and I said, I'm miserable. Why would I want somebody else to convert to this? This is awful. Of course it's not working. Why would they want to be like me? Because I hate this. I thought, something must be wrong with the way I'm approaching this. There must be something worthwhile to invite people into. So it must not be whatever I'm experiencing. So that kind of started me saying, well, I need to think differently about this. I'm not sure how I need to think, but I need to think differently. So I kind of started my journey with evangelism, started with ignorance, I'd say, and then it moved into kind of excitement, right? And then it moved into kind of maybe bitterness or burned. You know, I kind of felt burned by the whole thing. Wasn't really sure. I kind of said, I'm just going to stop that for now and figure out kind of what's going on with me and what's going on with me and God and how to do that. And then kind of from there, it's been kind of growing, and I'd call myself kind of recovering from some of that. You know, I'm convinced that the way God works in the world is to grow his kingdom, to invite people to know him. I'm really enjoying knowing God now. But a lot of the old ways I was taught to invite other people into that don't seem either to work or to be that very authentic to me. So I'm kind of on a journey myself of how do you do this? What does it look like? And one of the interesting things about the Bible when you start thinking about evangelism is it's a little bit ambiguous. If you read the Gospels, you get the idea that evangelism is very, very important, right? Jesus has a bunch of followers. He sends them out. He's preaching the gospel. He's trying to get people to come into the kingdom. If that's all you've got, you get to feeling like evangelism is a really big deal. But if you start reading the letters in the New Testament, Paul's letters and other letters, you don't hear much about evangelism. And so this is a little confusing, I think, because if evangelism is the singular purpose of life, if this is the reason why we're here, why don't we ever read Paul telling the churches, hey, you guys got to get off your butts and go evangelize. You got to get out there. You got to stop being so inward focused. We mostly don't read it. So either they were doing an amazing job already, or he had some sort of different focus. And there's a few hints that you should be kind of sensitive to outsiders. But for the most part, Paul seems concerned with what's going on in the church. He seems concerned with people's relationships, with how they're loving each other, with how they're treating their brothers and sisters. So you kind of have two different sides, and you go, well, how do you put those together? And then when you do think about evangelism, there's a lot of different metaphors in the New Testament for evangelism. Jesus says, I'm going to teach you to catch fish, right? So there's this fishing metaphor, and I don't really like fishing. So that metaphor, and it feels kind of weird to, like, catch a person. So that kind of, not sure about that one. Sometimes Paul talks in Acts, and Peter talks in Acts about persuasion, about there's this kind of debate thing. It's very clear there's ideas being presented and ideas being challenged. So there's kind of a debate idea. Other times there's war imagery used for evangelism, as if there's kind of powers that are in conflict and one is going to overcome the other. So that's an imagery that's used at times. But I think there's one metaphor that's used that I think maybe is more appropriate for our generation, maybe for our culture, I don't know. But that's the metaphor that I want to look at tonight, and that's the idea of romance, the idea of evangelism as romance, as participating in God trying to woo people to himself. So I'm going to read from John 3:25, and we're going to look at an example of this. So this is early in the New Testament. John the Baptist is baptizing people, and he's baptized Jesus and sent him out. I'm going to start in verse 22. So this is right after Jesus talks to Nicodemus. This is right after John 3:16, all that good stuff. So this happens. After this, Jesus and his disciples went out into the Judean countryside, where he spent some time with them and baptized. Now John was also baptizing at Aenon near Salim, because there was plenty of water, and people were constantly coming to be baptized. This was before John was put in prison, by the way, John adds. Verse 25, an argument developed between some of John's disciples and a certain Jew over the matter of ceremonial washing. They came to John and said, Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, the one you testified about, well, he is baptizing, and everyone is going to him. To this John replied, a man can receive only what is given him from heaven. You yourselves can testify that I said, I am not the Christ, but am sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him, and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine, and it is now complete. He must become greater, I must become less. So I'm going to suggest that John the Baptist presents a little bit of a different view of evangelism for us, of outreach. So this passage starts out with something that we're pretty familiar with. Verse 25, an argument developed between some of John's disciples and a certain Jew. So you have John's disciples, who were a certain type of Jew, and you have a certain Jew. We don't know anything about this certain Jew, but presumably he was a different kind of Jew. And they started having a debate about ceremonial washing. So does this ring a bell? Like two religious people debating something that doesn't really matter to anybody except them?
Yeah.
That's not familiar? So this kind of inter-debate is going on. So the scene starts out with an argument, with debate, with one person trying to say, you're wrong and I'm right, and this is how it works. Well, it pretty quickly changes. And the first thing I want to suggest is that outreach is not an argument. That evangelism is not about right and wrong. And I would say evangelism is somewhat about ideas, but it's not primarily about ideas. It's not about changing the way somebody thinks, about getting them to assent to a set of facts. It's not about that. I think it's about relationship. I think it's about introducing a relationship. But so much of what we think of when we think of evangelism is, here's this list of things you're supposed to believe. I need to get you to say okay to all of these, right? And it creates this us versus them. A bunch of us were over at Joe's house last night and watched this movie, Lord, Save Us From Your Followers, which was, I thought, pretty good, pretty effective kind of picture of some of where Christianity has gone astray, I think, in America, and presented kind of a bad side and been focused on ideas and convincing and you're wrong and it's them out there and us in here and you can be one of us if you just sign this, these certain things. So that's where I kind of see this passage starting. This passage starts with this debate, with this, come on, you need to believe this. Why don't you believe this? Tell me your arguments and I'll show you how my arguments are better. Right? But John doesn't let it go very far there. And then it kind of changes all of a sudden. And they come to John and they say this. That guy that you baptized, right? So John's baptizing. He baptizes somebody who happens to be Jesus. He says, that guy, now he's baptizing and everybody's going to him instead of us. Like, you baptized him, you're better than he is, and now they're all going to him. That's not fair. So there's this competitive thing going on, right? There's this idea of like, I want to establish my thing, right? And I think sometimes this can happen for evangelism. I think for me, part of my motivation in college to be evangelizing, to convince people of the truth of Christianity, was to kind of alleviate some of my own fears that maybe it wasn't true. But if I could convince this other person that it was true, then maybe it's true. See, it was about me. And maybe it was about some of this, like, well, everybody else is doing this, and I want to kind of come back and tell this great story, and everybody loves it, and I want to be the hero of the day. And yet that's not what it's about. It's not about our achievement. It's not about convincing people of the truth of something because we're insecure about its own truth. It's about something different. And this is, I think, one of the most remarkable pictures of somebody in Scripture, this picture of John the Baptist. And actually, Shin mentioned it last week when you were talking. So, first thing, outreach is not an argument. Outreach is not about me. So what is it about? Well, there's this arguing and competitive stuff going on, and what does John say? He changes the metaphor. He changes the rules. He says, I am not the Christ, but am sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. So what John the Baptist says is, I'm the best man. And it's my job to bring the bride and the bridegroom together. And when I do that, I celebrate. I don't get competitive because more people are going to Jesus. The whole point of what I'm doing is to bring Jesus, his bride. And I was looking into this a little bit and found out in ancient Near East culture, when the best man was actually a far more important role than it was, than it is kind of in our culture. And during the wedding ceremony, the best man would actually bring the bride and kind of present the bride to the groom and then would kind of fall back into shadows. And that's what John is saying here. This is my role. I'm the best man. I'm bringing the bride to the groom. So Perhaps a better metaphor for evangelism, then, is this idea of helping Jesus woo his lover. Helping the guy get the girl. Now, there's actually some rules around this. There's this concept of wingman. Have you heard of this? So, you know, you can think of evangelism as if we are Jesus' wingman. And you can actually go to this website where there are the 15 laws of wingman, of the wingman. And some of them are hard to translate into evangelism. Like the carry three condoms one. I'm not sure. Not sure how you do that one. But others of them are far more easy to translate into evangelism. But the idea is that there's a guy whose sole role is to help the other guy get the girl. And his whole focus is to, if there's other guys that this girl is looking at, his job is to defame them, you know, say bad things about them. If there's other girls interested in the guy, he runs interference. His whole role is to get this girl to respond to this guy. Now, the metaphor breaks down pretty quickly. Mostly because the guy really isn't expressing this genuinely deep, profound love for this woman. He probably just wants to sleep with her. But the idea of having this role of kind of coming alongside and helping people to know who Jesus is, helping Jesus win his bride, who is the church. And that's what it's about. And I think if we have that picture, some of the things that become frustrating about evangelism might be viewed a little bit differently. Because then it's not us and them anymore. It's Jesus and his bride. There's no kind of inside and outside. There's this lover who's wooing this woman. And wooing her by sacrificing himself. By giving everything, not by trying to, you know, I'm a little out of the game, but, guys, how does it work when you, like, try and prove a girl that she's wrong and you're right? Does that usually, like, get her? I'm guessing no, right? That's not kind of the smoothest way to operate. So it's not anymore about proving who's right and who's wrong. It's about expressing love. It's about an invitation into a relationship. So, why do girls like wedding rings? Sorry, engagement rings. Why do you want a big diamond?
Sparkly.
Sparkly. Okay. But cupid zirconia is pretty sparkly, too.
I could live with that.
Okay. Why do other girls? Okay. Consumer culture.
No.
What else?
Some women think it shows how much the guy loves her.
How much the guy loves her, okay.
It's a sign of commitment.
Sign of commitment.
Thank you. Are you talking about why they like a big diamond or why they like having a ring on their hand?
Yeah, why a diamond? Why this really
expensive
thing?
That's a different answer than what she just gave.
A diamond can express commitment.
How much money are you willing to put down to show... Because how much money you put down is going to tell me how much I'm worth to you.
All right, there it is. Lady has described it.
I'm telling you.
All right, tell me how it is.
I'm telling you how it is. I mean,
so,
it's not what I think. I'm telling you what it is that the culture has told us to tell you.
But some women think that, okay.
Some women do think that way.
So is it fair to say... The engagement ring is an expression of personal sacrifice to demonstrate the value of the other person.
If you'd like to spend that much on chocolate for me.
Wow, that's a lot of chocolate. Wow.
Kidding. It doesn't sparkle, but it does taste from
the wrapper longer.
Diamonds last longer than chocolate.
That much chocolate.
Yeah, that much chocolate could last a long time. Okay. Okay, so work with me here. So if the diamond ring is an expression of personal sacrifice that demonstrates the value of the other person, what's the parallel?
What did Jesus sacrifice to demonstrate our value? Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah. Nice.
Check. Can I go home? We done here?
So, the cross becomes, Jesus' death becomes a demonstration of how far he's willing to go to woo his bride. The demonstration of how big a ring he's willing to get.
Has one shiny ring.
Has one shiny ring. Very costly.
What did the dude get?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Why?
The dude dies.
The dude gets the girl.
Hello.
So, the other thing that's interesting, I think, about this is, you know, one of the tricky things in our culture is this idea, why is Jesus the only way? What is it about, what is it that's unique about Jesus? Well, if Christianity is about a conflict of ideas, a worldviews, then there could be a lot of worldviews out there, right? And some of them have some good stuff, and some of them have others, and you can kind of debate them, and there's some that are more valuable than others, but all of them have some value. But if Christianity is about a love relationship between a man and a woman, then I think people get the idea of exclusivity a lot quicker. Because most people, when they're in a relationship with somebody, don't want anybody else to be in that relationship. Most women don't want that man to be pursuing other women. And most men don't want to marry a woman and then for her to be also marrying other men. So this idea of kind of, well, if this is Jesus wooing his bride, the Father loving his people, of course it's only one. Of course there's only one way. There's only one true relationship. You can't go cheating around. You can't go kind of have this open relationship.
Forgive me, but doesn't that metaphor only work in Western cultures? Considering the fact that often
because
other
of polygamy?
Cultures either have polygamy or arranged marriages or kind of don't view relationships in that regard, in that way?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to speak of about all cultures, but I'll try.
I don't know. I'm thinking in terms of, like, you know, typically missionaries will go to cultures that don't necessarily view marriage relationships in the way that we do. So,
but I think the idea of like monogamy, though it's not universally practiced, is valued commonly in other cultures. Even in arranged marriage, I mean, the marriage is arranged,
but it's still monogamous.
You're still not going to cheat on them. Now the question of polygamy, I'm not familiar enough.
I was curious.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably, I mean, I don't really know, it's probably also a matter of, like, who has the power, and, like, is that the ideal situation for the woman?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she might still be jealous, but that's the way that things work.
That's the way it works, right. That's what I would think, but I'd have to know more about those cultures to speak about.